With us in studio this morning, we have Judge Catherine McGuinness, former Justice of the Supreme Court. Nora Owen, former Fine Gael Minister for Justice, Gerald Keane, solicitor, Sam Smith, independent newspapers journalist, and Jim Power, economist, and you're all very, very welcome indeed. Let me start with Nora Owen. The Bertie Ahern story, I'm a quitter. As somebody who's put in a life in politics, do you have any sympathy for him?
Well, I think he brought this down on himself. I mean, we can't second guess the tribunal. The tribunal has been very clear that it says they don't believe a word Bertie Ahern said. And I suppose most of the papers today, all the papers are covering the story from one end of the scale to the other. And you just pick your page and pick which bit of the story you want.
Which ones did you?
Well, I mean, there were a couple of stories that I found interesting. In the Mail, there was a piece about Celia Larkin by Ben Haw. And Celia was also obviously in the tribunal, wasn't believed either. But in the articles she wrote in The Independent, and she wrote, this is an article about her, she talks about how glad she was that Bertie wasn't found corrupt. But at no stage does she actually handle the issue that she herself was accused of lying. And she was quite frank about Bertie. She said he could be vague, belligerent, evasive and downright rude, but sort of like, I still loved him and I'm still glad that he's safe. I mean, what we have now is the people like Bertie Ahern and Pádraig Flynn and others all coming out now to say none of this is true. And that's very damaging as well to the whole system of the tribunals. I mean, I don't know where this is going to end. Another part of the story, you know, pick out the bits that matter to you, I suppose, in a way. We have this SIPO, the Standards in Public Office. And years back, some of these contributions that Bertie said were gifts or loans were brought to the SIPO. And SIPO said, sorry, can't do anything about it. They were given before the SIPO was set up. And also, they were loans. But now it doesn't look as if Bertie is going to be able to prove their loans. So that, again, draws another part of the state back in again as to why these things were not examined way back. And, you know, there's articles by people like Michael McDougall about other things, and they went into government. Matt Cooper in the Sunday Times, I think it is, talks about, look, it's too late for Ahern's people to say sorry. We knew about these things. But, of course, as long as the tribunal was sitting, no party or individual or Sam or anybody could actually say these are true facts and some action should be taken now. It's only now that the report is out that this can happen.
Catherine McGuinness, you were mildly critical, as I recall, on the programme here before about tribunals in general.
Yes, about the sort of tribunals that we had. I was critical because I thought that, generally speaking, we had allowed ourselves to go into them with a somewhat vague description of their terms of reference, and that it was allowed to spread out and spread out. I think really we were talking about the Moriarty Tribunal at the time when I made those criticisms. But this again, I think we've all learnt from this, and the Law Reform Commission produced a bill for a whole reform of the tribunal system that would control the costs, would control the time, would control the terms of reference, and would have a kind of small administration to administer tribunals to make sure that they didn't get out of hand. I mean, for instance, the story about today about that you mentioned about the expenses for the judges, even in the story, it does admit that these expenses were on the usual scale for circuit judges. And as it happens, Gerald Keyes and Mary Faherty lived out of Dublin and they were allowed to claim for getting to their work. When this was. But that's the kind of thing that should have been organised in advance to say, how is this going to be handled? How are we going to control this money? And I think we really need to change the way the whole things work. And I think that's true. And after all, when it came to the Murphy report, the whole manner of doing investigations was changed, and it was faster, it was cheaper, it brought out the truth just as well, if not better.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think looking back on these tribunals and some of the criticisms I think that Celia Larkin makes about what it was like appearing in the tribunal in her actually kind of quite moving article in The Independent. About how difficult it was and how much was looked into her whole background. Of course they had to do that, but the kind of legalistic atmosphere in which it was done was
yeah, her
probably,
description
yes.
of the of going in there
yeah.
was quite compelling. Now, yeah. I, as you say, I know these things have to be done, but I mean, she was. I mean, basic things. She was afraid her heel would break on her shoe because there are cobblestones, which one can identify with, yeah. you know. And the nervousness and keeping your composure and all of that, and she and it was like that. She was the criminal.
Yes, well, that would give that impression because of the way in which. All the huge amount of legal representation that was allowed, that's another question that has to be looked at if you're organising a tribunal yeah. now or if you were organising an investigation now. The huge level of legal representation, which meant that she would be cross-examined by three or four different people. And being a witness is actually nerve-wracking. I mean, I've been a witness in court myself, and even though I spent all my life in court, I was still very, very nervous myself. And therefore, and I mean, I was only talking about how my car was stolen and how I identified it, which was relatively simple, so that I can, you know, I can sympathise with how she felt. But I think that probably it was built up into too heavy a level of cross-examination by several different lawyers. And whether she was lying or not, there's a way of cross-examining that can bring out the truth without creating quite such a kind of dramatic situation as she describes.
Sam, you are kind of held responsible in some ways for all of this, or partially responsible. The coverage today on Bertie yeah. and his resignation and Fianna Fáil and is it down, is it out, and how the tribunals have affected other governments as well, it has to be said. What's just on the coverage, what did you think today?
Well, what I thought today is a lot of people are almost getting competitively angry about Bertie Ahern. Anybody who was in the tribunal when he was being questioned, I don't think they would have any doubt that his answers were incredible. You know, they were just, it just wasn't possible to believe them. When somebody turns around and says, you know, I won the money on a horse, which is thing. I remember there's a street trader. I'll not identify.
People do win money on horses, by the way. Look at that young man down in yes. wherever oh, that yes. was over at Cheltenham.
But you have to go and bet on them. That's the difference.
Yes. Who's a street trader on Baggot Street called me over the day after that event. He says, do you see that about Bertie in the paper? And I said, I did. He says, I back horses. He says, and let me tell you, Sam Smith, he says, if somebody wins on a horse, they know the time of the race, the name of the horse, the meeting where it was and everything about it. And I think for a lot of people, that was just where it all fell apart. And frankly, Bertie Ahern's evidence was incredible. It was impossible to believe him. And it went on for a long time. And it was painful for anybody that was there to behold. But, you know, that's it. It was there. It's when we hear it again officially, gift-wrapped between the covers of a tribunal report, that people say, oh, it's thing. But all that time ago, I just thought, I just don't believe a word that's going on here. This guy's got money. Now, it's an awful lot of money if you haven't got it. Not that much money, really. Do you know, what was it, 200,000-odd? But it has destroyed his life. It has destroyed his career. We still don't know where the money come from. I would like to know who gave him that money. We'll probably never find out who yeah. gave it to him. And that will be the thing that has destroyed the most successful politician of his generation.
Gerald Keane?
Yeah, it's certainly compelling. There's a lot of compelling pieces in the papers this morning. I think I summed it up, I suppose. Some surprised me. I mean, I think a lot of grassroots members of Fianna Fáil will be quaking in their boots this morning when they read John Drennan in The Independent and Tom McGuirk in The Business Post, because Tom McGuirk describes Fianna Fáil as having terminal cancer. And both articles and both journalists are calling on the disbandment of Fianna Fáil as a party. So I think there's just saying it's all over for them. Just, you know, you're finished. Yeah, then as against
Noel
that, you have...
Noel Whelan comes out of the family.
Yeah. I found that's right. It's then interesting to go to Vincent Brown, who's saying that he's blaming the politicians of all parties at the time who didn't burst Bertie's bubble. And then you've Matt Cooper in the Times, who blames all the people who voted for Fianna Fáil in the election.
Does make the point that what Sam was talking about was in the public arena.
It was in public arena
before that election.
Before that, it was very much so. And he does it, I think, in a compelling way. I thought Celia Larkin's article was the one that I certainly enjoyed reading the most, because you quite rightly say she talks about her heels breaking on the cobble-locked driveway. She then goes on to say, when I got into the box, had I remembered to bring a hanky? My nose always runs when I'm stressed. Now, I think that's why Bertie has three or four hankies with him a lot of the time. I don't know. What if I cry? I cry so easily. And then it goes on to talk about a more serious matter, which I'm sure Catherine would understand, where she's asked for discovery on a Wednesday, mm-hmm. and then on a Friday they seek an order of the court for discovery against her. And it looks as if she's not cooperating. Mm-hmm. I think it's a fairly valid point. It's almost like I'm not cooperating. In 2 days you don't produce discovery. Mm-hmm. It could take weeks, if not months. Yeah. And then she goes on to say, in hindsight, there were some funny moments, like when City Council Henry Murphy, having berated me for not remembering the exact details of issues, had himself no recollection as whether mobile phones were in use 15 years ago or not. So I thought the whole article was quite interesting, and I would certainly recommend that people read it. I thought it kind of brought a human interest angle to the entire process. Whether you accept it or not is up to the readership.
Yeah.
But what was interesting about The Independent was that Celia has a full article, Bertie Ahern has a half page. The Indo clearly decided to open the pages to all. I mean, Celia Larkin is still writing. There were questions asked about her. There was another paper. There was a young woman who was writing for a daily paper, and after the tribunal report, she was let go. I mean, I'm just wondering what the status of people
that is.
I didn't notice whether Willie
O'Dea
has written it this Sunday. I forgot to look. Did Willie write this Sunday?
No, but the big news today is that Bertie Ahern intends to challenge the tribunal. Yeah. Now, that of itself is hugely significant because, when you challenge a tribunal, for instance, the Moriarty Tribunal wasn't challenged. You have 3 months to go to the courts to challenge it. So therefore, you have to assume that either they accepted the findings of the tribunal, or actually, as Dennis O'Brien said on Pat Kenny the morning after, that he wouldn't trust the judges to hear any, which is an astonishing thing to say. But
I find that rather hurtful, seeing as I was a judge that actually presided over one of Dennis O'Brien's libel cases, the one against the Mirror, and he got a very large award indeed, so that I don't know what he's criticising us for.
I think he might be suggesting that judges wouldn't break ranks.
That's what he was saying in that interview, which is not on the web anymore.
The fact that Bertie now is going to challenge it, I mean, where does that leave the report stand? It just stands there kind of in a limbo.
Yeah.
And then he goes and challenges. But doesn't he put himself now in the position where the judges in any appeal he has to actually show where this money came from, which he didn't manage to do over 15 years.
Again, I presume, Nora, that's what they'll do. They'll have a look at that. Now, that said, I doubt if somebody's going to sit for another 15 years.
I doubt
if much is going to be done on the report anyway. Yeah. I think this is just another issue. But I think when you finish reading the papers this morning, it brings me back to the great phrase that in crime they say grab the money and run. In politics, it's run and then grab the money.
Yes. And how cheaply they all sold themselves on.
If he's challenging it, doesn't it matter? I mean, Gerard would appreciate this too. I mean, if it's a judicial review, the challenge, they just look at the manner in which the tribunal did it the technicalities of it. It isn't really the truth or falsehood of the evidence. So maybe he's moving in that direction.
Wouldn't that cost a fortune?
I'm sure it would. I mean, there's no doubt it would cost a fortune.
But then you've got Leopardstown twice next year. There's two meetings. You've got Nays.
Celia Larkin also made the point that she couldn't do it because she just couldn't afford to do it. Jim, you've been sitting there.
I think Sam's point there that nothing that was published last week has come as a surprise to anybody. I mean, it was all out there, anybody that followed the evidence. And it was totally incredible. You just could not believe what he was saying. And
yet Charlie Chalk and Joe Burke were absolutely adamant that they gave him the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I suppose the damage to Fianna Fáil is one of the bigger long-term issues and the implications of that for the Irish political system. I mean, you mentioned Noel Whelan's piece yesterday, but you look at another luminary of Fianna Fáil, Padraig Flynn, I mean, his reputation has been destroyed as well. And
well, Pat, that suggests Pat, that it was high before this report.
But Pat Leahy has a piece on the... Well, I'd forgotten about Pádraig Flynn, to be honest, until it was. I was really reminded
about it.
I know, but there was an interesting piece on the back of the Sunday Business Post by Pat Leahy. The 50k that Tom Gilmartin gave Pádraig Flynn that was used to buy a farm for his wife. Dorothy Flynn received over 200,000 in state grants for planting trees
on that farm.
I think on that farm. So I think that'll go down very well with the people.
Although, Jim, as you say there about Fianna Fáil and people are banging the drum on the funereal march for Fianna Fáil, in the presidential election, you know, one of the things said about Sean Gallagher was that he was a closet Fianna Fáil candidate, came second.
Yeah.
And in the Dublin West by-election... Yes. Shortly after that, Fianna Fáil came second, I think. So I really would not be so quick to write off a DNA that is very firmly imprinted in the Irish psyche.
There's one thing I about agree. The Pádraig Flynn, just to finish on Jim's thing there. In Matt Cooper's article in the Sunday Times, he says that Pádraig Flynn should have been reported to the Gardaí. The Revenue Commissioners actually charged him penalties and interest on top of the unpaid tax. So the Revenue, obviously, in 2004 decided that he had kept that 50,000 and got tax on it. But what's interesting is that even yet it was a donation for Fianna Fáil, and Fianna Fáil never, I mean, it's hard enough to raise money for political parties. Mm. They never went after the money, even in 2004 when it was clear that Pádraig had kept it, because he wouldn't have been charged tax on it if he hadn't kept it, if they couldn't prove he kept it. So, I mean, those kind of things are all questions that I suppose people will continue to ask.
Isn't there also a question over the ownership of St. Luke's? That's covered in the paper, where some people thought it was Fianna Fáil.
Now it's owned by a trust, isn't that?
Trust.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Burke, Mr. Richardson.
Well, you yourself,
but the Fianna Fáil party is going after it.
They're going after it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Joe Burke was on the programme yesterday, and he's one of the three trustees.
That's right.
Mm. And he was saying that worldwide, the beneficiary of any trust can be changed. The trustees remain, but the beneficiary can change.
Change, yeah.
Now, I don't know, would he do that to Fianna Fáil?
He must have access to very sophisticated legal advice.
He sounded very kind of... I mean, he kept denying to you that he was really saying that they were thinking of changing it. But listening to him, I certainly felt they're thinking of changing it, you know.
But what does it do to some of the senior people in Fianna Fáil today? I mean, Willie O'Dea, you know, and his behaviour, particularly in relation to the tribunal over the last few years... and his relationship with Bertie Ahern, the way he defended him at every opportunity. Likewise with Micheál Martin. I mean, Micheál Martin stood shoulder to shoulder with Bertie Ahern over many years. I think Fianna Fáil needs to clean out.
But didn't the tribunal fail in... I think they failed in one thing, in that they made very strong comment about ministers trying to, you know, thwart the tribunal. I think they have an onus to name them, because not every comment was damaging to the tribunal. But if they made that right up in the very first section of the report, before you got into the 3,000 pages at all, they said the clear evidence was that people were trying to bring down the tribunal. They really do have an onus, I think. They've named everybody else in it. They should be naming the ministers that they are blaming.
I think another significant issue of all of this is what it does to Ireland's international reputation. Radio 4 led it as a headline last Friday morning, for example. It's got blanket coverage globally. What does that do to Ireland's reputation? Interesting question.
It's certainly not good. And the other point, and correct me if I'm wrong with this, the tribunal didn't say that Bertie Ahern was not corrupt. It said that there was no evidence, of corruption.
But that is a bit weaselly now to say, you know. Yeah. But they didn't say he was corrupt, so you know they didn't say he wasn't corrupt, so therefore he may be corrupt.
Yeah.
I mean, if he is corrupt, what that implies to me is that if you give somebody money and then they do something in return for that, that to me is
corruption.
You know, black and white corruption.
Yeah.
Now, curiously, a year ago this week, we had a tribunal report that said that a government minister in a government where you served, Nora, he had received somewhere £994,000 from someone for whom he secured the biggest contract in the history of the state that made him a billionaire. Now, internationally, I would have thought that is quite shocking. Now, the tribunal chairman, Mr. Justice Moriarty, did not use the C word because chairman of tribunals cannot make a finding that is, you know, implying a criminal act of some sort. But I presume you must have been really shocked when you heard that at that time.
Well, I was, and I was in government with at the time when the contract was given, and it was explained to us who had won it, and it was.
Can I ask you a question, Nora? When you were sitting around the cabinet table, and it was decided that you wouldn't take the highest bid, did nobody? I remember listening to an explanation of why the bidding would go in a particular way that would not include taking the highest bid. Did nobody say? Why the heck not? It's money for the state.
Well, as you know, there's cabinet confidentiality, so even at this stage, I would still be bound by that. But I mean, it's been quite publicly said how, you know, the matter was brought to the leaders of the parties, and then it was brought to the full cabinet, and the decision was made, and then Michael Lowry went out and announced it. It doesn't always follow that the highest or the lowest bid in something is accepted because
the whole thing comes around, included in the pot, wouldn't you?
I mean, look, that tribunal report is sitting there now. Michael Lowry is still a member of the Dáil, stood and got elected at top of the poll.
That's what you have to look at,
you know, Bertie Ahern continued to get, even though in 2007 a lot of this stuff was known.
Absolutely,
I imagine if P. Flynn had stood again, he probably would have got elected at top because he brought the ring roads to Castlebar.
Huge donations that were given to Fine Gael at that time. Remember,
£50,000
from that Norwegian telephone
Telenor, was it?
And you know, I haven't read every page of the report, but I've read some of it. And you know, after all my years in politics and all, there's an onus on the TDs and constituencies. They're obliged to sort of raise the funds to run the elections in their constituency. And you're considered to be less of a TD and less good as a TD if you don't make some efforts. And I've reached the conclusion now that even if the tribunal recommendation of €55 was accepted, honest to God, I'm beginning to think that the public is just going to have to get used to the idea that if politics is to be paid for, it's got to be paid for by the state and by the taxpayer. Yeah. Because as long as there's even tuppence or 2 cent allowed, you have a lunch, you have a golf classic, you have anything at all, a table quiz, people would say,
darts competition.
Yes. 2 years later, if anybody who was at that table quiz manages to get a contract for anything, somebody will remember that they paid €20 for a table quiz to so-and-so and were they very close to them. So we really have reached a point, and this has really exposed that flaw in the whole concept of funding. Yes. State pays certain monies to political parties to run their day-to-day work, but they're absolutely precluded from using any of that to run the elections. Yeah. I've done elections all over the world, and I'm beginning to think we have to re-look at the whole postering. Maybe we have to designate certain areas in towns and villages where there's enough room for five posters for each candidate. That's the only place they can put them up. Reduce the spend on it. But the minute the election starts, the frenzy of getting your posters, getting your old plastic stuff that you put your posters on, getting the ties, getting the literature, and of course you're useless if you don't do five drops during a campaign. And each of those drops, even to deliver them, will cost you €2,000 or €3,000 euros. So we are feeding into a system all the time where we've got to raise funds. And I got very depressed the other morning. I said, I really don't know how anybody could ask anybody for any money to fund a political party.
Yes.
I don't know, Jim, whether you agree.
I agree 100%, absolutely.
And we see the extreme of this in the United States, where you can't stand for the office of president, for instance, unless you're a multimillionaire. And the enormous amount of money that's spent on negative advertising and so on. I mean, obviously, we're not as far as that. But
we're getting there.
The same principle applies. Yes. And I think it's perhaps almost worse in a small country like this, what Nora is talking about. You can't help knowing a lot of people. And then the accusation that you're very close to so-and-so. Well, perhaps you are, but that's the way it is if you only have this number of people.
Yeah, I think I remember a few years ago on the programme here, Marion, I was critical of the publicity surrounding Mary Harney's hairdo or blowjob and her hair or whatever down in Florida. And I was saying that if she was running health properly at the time, I felt it was much more important to concentrate that if she was doing her job properly at the time as Minister for Health, they were small side issues that were taking her attention unfairly. And again, I see this happening today because I really don't agree, and I've been critical of this government in a number of areas and of what they're doing. But I think the Maeve Sheehan article and the hullabaloo around Enda Kenny on a stage with Dennis O'Brien is a bridge too far. I really do, because I don't see, and I think it's wrong to suggest, you know, that this has ruined Enda Kenny's visit to New York, the ringing of the bell, that there's 20 odd people or 25 people. He's not controlling the guest list, and Dennis O'Brien is four or five people
he's
away from
him. He's not controlling the guest list.
No, he's not. No, he wasn't. It was case. No, not in this picture.
It was Ireland Inc.
It was Ireland Inc. controlling, yeah.
Which is linked
this,
to
it's Dennis almost like this, yeah. You know, it's almost, you know, I'm saying nothing against Dennis O'Brien, but it's almost saying that there's an association there just because the two of them are on a stage together. And I think that's going a little bit too far as well. And it's also sidetracking the issue, the real issues of what we should be talking about. But
for instance, Gerard, I'm just looking here, there's something that says, you know, we do not live in some sort of post-communist Russian oligarchy where the greatest and the good pose as the great and the good, live offshore for tax reasons. And in my opinion, this is Michael McDowell writing this morning, seek influence and control of the media. These are very, very wealthy people against whom shocking findings were made last year. One of them, that nearly $1 million was paid to a serving government minister who secured the biggest contract in the history of the state given to them. If a year after that, you know, report is made by a very eminent, and I'm sure Catherine would agree that Mr. Justice Michael Moriarty is a most honourable man, if he finds that last year, and twice recently the Taoiseach of this country ignores that report and says, oh well, I'll go out and endorse this person. It basically endorses what happened at that time, ignores the report.
Well, presumably Mr. Kenny would disagree.
No, I don't think he's endorsing. I don't think that paragraph endorses.
Can I just say that we had a statement in before the programme on behalf of Mr. Dennis O'Brien saying that, because Michael McDowell wrote that, Mr. Michael McDowell SC was retained by the Moriarty Tribunal in 2010. Counsel for Dennis O'Brien and others objected to Mr. McDowell at that time on the basis that he had a conflict of interest and was biased and therefore should not act for the tribunal. This matter is the subject of legal proceedings before the Supreme Court. Can I just ask you, Nora Owen, in terms of optics, what do you think of that picture?
Well, I don't know who invited the people to stand there. I think it's, you know, when you go as Taoiseach, you're invited to ring the bell.
I think it's associated with Dennis O'Brien.
Yeah, but I mean, I imagine the invitation came directly to Enda Kenny to stand there. I don't know the details of how he, to ring the bell. And the people around him were not his invites. They were just there. I mean, I read Michael McDowell's article and I thought, Michael is busily at home going through his photo albums, cutting himself out of every picture with Bertie Ahern. Remember, Michael was in the government with Bertie. Yeah. He was made AG by Bertie. You know, so he's out there cutting all these pictures out of his albums and his records.
Gerard, do you think that's unfair?
I think it's unfair. And also, I'm just looking here, I think he was actually invited a year ago, Enda was.
To do this. I think the invitation,
I'm just trying to read it here because I read it last night. I think the invitation came directly from the Stock Exchange, Euronext, or something like that. And the guesses. I just think it's a little bit unfair. I mean, I think at the reality dictates that at the pace that Taoiseach is moving at, it's very difficult. I mean, we could have a mass murder in here that shouldn't be there. I'm just saying the pace he's moving at, it's very difficult. He's in, he's out, he's gone, he's speaking.
Oh, if that happened by accident, certainly, you're right.
I think if he was having dinner with them, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with having dinner with them, I'm just saying that's an association that's a little bit closer.
Easy now.
I think it's just a little bit closer. But, you know, a podium in the New York Stock Exchange. And I will tell you in a minute, I think he was invited a year ago, Enda was.
Well, normally people would know he was going to America for the St. Patrick's Day, so I'd say invitation.
I was in New York last weekend.
All right.
And I was asked, did I want to go to that event by somebody connected to business and finance?
Yes.
But I had no interest in going anyway. But people were invited. Well, some people were.
Yeah.
But not by Enda Kenny, absolutely not.
No, but the one thing I would actually try and make clear too, you read out that statement from Mr. O'Brien's public relations people. My understanding is that Michael McDowell, yes, they did object to him, but my understanding is that Mr. O'Brien asked Mr. McDowell, or Mr. O'Brien's lawyers asked Michael McDowell to represent him before he objected to him appearing. And at that time, Michael McDowell had been retained by the tribunal. So, you know, he had a conflict.
Is that on the record?
Well, I have it from impeccable sources.
Right.
Yeah.
Catherine, do you see a conflict of interest there?
In the Michael McDougall thing. Well, the argument that I remember being made at the time was that Michael McDougall was conflicted because he had made remarks about the tribunal, that he had, as a member of the government, that he had kind of, as it were, been very critical one way or another of Denis O'Brien already, and that Denis O'Brien felt that he shouldn't have been hired as a lawyer in the particular at the particular time. I don't think he was, I mean, I didn't know anything about what Sam is saying here, obviously, but the kind of argument that was made at the time, I don't think you could say that he was technically conflicted. But and in the end, I think that he, you know, his performance as a barrister, and it was the normal performance of any barrister who would have had that brief.
I don't remember the Moriarty having the same statement as the Mahon one has about anybody outside of the tribunal complaining and trying to thwart it. It's interesting that the Mahon tribunal felt it necessary to put that in, in the report.
Can we not criticise things?
Well, I think you can, but I think you have to be careful how you do it.
I would say, and in fact, I'm right here. And I'd say, the Taoiseach rolled into the New York Stock Exchange for the bell ringing ceremony. It was on foot of a long standing invitation from Duncan Niederer, Chief Executive of the New York Stock Exchange. You're next. Mm-hmm. I did see that, so.
But I mean, to come back to the point, I mean,
well, you can. I think you can make comments about the tribunal, but I think there must have been three or four comments that really hit home to the judges.
Well, is that
that's
too
why I think it's important. Well, yeah, I wondered about that because, I mean, like, as a counsellor, I was in there as well, and I know what Celia's talking about. It's a very frightening kind of experience. I was never in court before. But, like, the tribunal was set up by the Oireachtas, and I suppose there's an onus on Oireachtas members as a result of that to be careful what they say about how they do their work, because they've given them a piece of law under which they've been established, and they must be careful. Of course, lots of people criticise the fees of the lawyers. They criticise the time of the sitting, the time they didn't sit, the time they broke for lunch, the time they did, you know, had coffee and all the rest. But some of the comments clearly went, in their view, further than that. So that's a kind of another side. I was listening to all this stuff during the week, and I thought it's a bit like buses. You wait for one and then 10 come together. Mm-hmm. The journalists got, what a week they got, between the 30 billion, between the sad and awful stuff in Toulouse, then this tribunal. They didn't know where to turn, which stories to follow and write. The details today have just scattered to everything.
You need to discriminate the different types of criticism, what the basis of it was. And clearly some of the criticism, particularly coming from the Fianna Fáil side, was totally to try and support Bertie Ahern.
Some of it was against, there was very prurient questioning at times by counsel. Now, that's not necessary. You know, sometimes people have to do that to find things out. But there was some very prurient, and some of the things I remember at the time, people saying, well, is this, you know, it's not just Bertie Ahern, the office of the Taoiseach is involved and so on. But when you live in a republic, the cat can look at the king, I suppose, isn't that it?
That's it. Absolutely. That's it. They can indeed. Well, it'll be interesting to see how Fianna Fáil progresses, and it will be interesting to see if Bertie Ahern will challenge the tribunal, given the sums of money you were talking about. I would imagine that would merely be a drop in the ocean in terms of the costs he would have to pay if he challenged.
Yeah, and presumably there would be sponsors out there who may well put up the money for him to do it.
There's a tiny little piece in the Sunday the Sunday World at the end of Amanda Brunker's column, and it says, "I will not pay the house tax." And it's a quote from Bertie: "I believe in paying my taxes and being a good citizen, but will I be paying the household tax? The answer is no." So that's interesting.
Bertie,
maybe he doesn't. Yes, maybe he doesn't own any houses at this stage. I don't know his situation.
Well, no, no, it's left. Wait a minute. What about does it? Is it not owned, still owned by Michael Wall?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Anyway, listen, we'll be coming to that later. And I didn't realise that Bertie Ahern had said that. We'll be coming to that later. But I'm going to take a break now. With us today in studio are Jim Power, Sam Smith, Gerald Keane, Nora Owen, and Catherine McGuinness.
1850 715 150.
Welcome back to the programme. Now we're going to the telephone and to Paul Williams, who was writing in the Irish Sun today about Steve Collins and his family. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Marion.
They left this morning, did they?
Just in the past hour or so, yeah. We said goodbye to them.
Remind our listeners of who Steve Collins is. I mean, they know him, but just remind them of who he is and what he did.
Well, Steve Collins gave evidence against Wayne Dundon, a member of the McCarthy-Dundon family, who are known as Murder Incorporated. They're probably the most dangerous criminal gang in the history of the state. In 2004, his adopted son Ryan, who was refused entry to Annabelle Dundon, their younger sister, 14, he was shot in the legs by a man wearing a helmet and carrying an automatic pistol. After that, the Collins, Steve and Ryan testified against Wayne Dundon, and he was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison ultimately. Since then, they have been targeted on a consistent basis. In 2008, Steve, a contract for $75,000 was issued to kill two people. One of them was Steve, and the other was a man called McNamara from Limerick here. About a month later, another totally innocent man called Shane Gagan was shot dead in mistake for Mr. McNamara. And then on April the 9th, 3 years ago, James Dillon, a 24-year-old gunman working for the McCarthy Dundons, walked into his business premises that he had next door to his dad's pub, the Steering Wheel on Roxburgh Road, and shot him dead. And he actually, Roy died in his dad's arms. Since then, McCarthy Dundons, despite this, and as a result of that horrific murder, it really did galvanise people. But it was Steve who emerged as a very, very courageous. And I know that the national conversation at the moment is about the human attributes of integrity and honesty and decency. But this man certainly is the epitome of that. He stood up against these people. He brought over 5,000-6,000 people out onto the streets of Limerick. His campaigning resulted in the introduction of very hard-hitting anti-gang legislation. And he basically very bravely stood up and became an icon for the victims of crime, because the problem is with the victims of crime that only far too often they are either afraid to speak out or are just so totally demoralised by what has happened to them that they can't. And Steve, then he won a Person of the Year award. He is featured on several TV programmes
and on radio programmes.
And he gave a few years ago a very, very powerful and heart-wrenching interview to yourself. And this morning, Steve, his wife Carmel, his daughter Leanne and his son Steve Jr., the kids along with their partners, they packed their bags and they got on a plane and they have moved into a relocation program far, far away. And as Steve explains in the story today, you know, in the end, they just have to try and start a new life.
Yeah, I remember he went in, you know, he really did suffer consequences for his own bravery, including attacks on him that sounded absolutely terrifying. And then he had permanent protection by the police. But his wife, as you in your article today, talks about, you know, that everywhere they go, they're watched by armed guard. And while the presence of them was saving their lives, dreadful existence.
Well, they don't have any privacy, and that they were very, very going to great pains to emphasise. Look, this is nothing personal with the police or anything like that. It's just that every time, as Steve says, he gets up in the morning, looks out, and he sees two young guards sitting waiting for him outside, he is reminded of what happened. And the thing is that, as well, that the threat, he makes one very poignant comment today where he says, you know, the last time I thought the Dundons were gone out of our lives, an order was sent from prison to murder Roy. Like, they don't go away, these people. And also Steve and Carmel are very, very concerned for their children who are in their 20s, because living under that very, very constrained environment of being surrounded by police, because, and also with the constant, there was also, and Steve makes this point as well, it was the serious effect it had on their mental health as a family, because there's this constant stress that just doesn't go away. And they wanted to get their kids, Steve and Carmel, they're a wonderful, wonderful family, and that's why it makes all of this so absolutely mind-numbing, to think that people who are such good decent, honest people who had never any involvement with any kind of crime, never did anything, paid their taxes, by the way, didn't depend on dig-outs, you know, that they are being forced out of their homes and out of their
country. Apparently there were no dig-outs, Paul, according to the tribunal. That's just
we're all to see, I was trying to talk to Steve Collins about that one this morning, you know. It is a very sad day for people, and it's particularly, like yesterday, I was down with them yesterday here in Limerick, and for the past 48 hours, you know, they've been going through this emotionally draining experience of having to say goodbye to all their loved ones and family and their friends.
Yeah.
It has been, and also the worst for them of all is leaving Roy's grave, leaving because they said they would never leave. But the point was, in the end, that they thought when James Dillon, for example, was convicted of Roy's murder, that they could relax, maybe try and forget, and maybe move on with their lives. But they realised over the past while that they couldn't. And so in the past 6 months, they've been involved in this very secretive process of negotiating with their host country and also with the help of the Garda International Liaison and Protection Unit and Garda Headquarters and the Department of Justice. And they're extremely thankful to the government, to both governments, because, in fact, the Minister for Justice, Dermot Ahern, and Alan Shatter were very, very helpful to them. Made the move.
Yeah. Nora Owen, as a former Minister for Justice, this kind of... You feel so defeated by this because it's game, set, and match to the gangs.
Well, it is. First of all, we should say to Paul Williams, he has kept this information before us for a long time. So there's great praise due to Paul for reminding us of what the effects and the after effects of what has happened to the Collins family. It's a terrible state of affairs that somebody is driven out. I mean, it's as if they're the guilty ones. Yeah. They're being driven out. They have to leave behind everything. And they have to stay out of touch. You know, they are going to a new life. Paul didn't mention it. I don't know whether they have to change their names and get new papers.
They're not actually going into witness, full witness, because Steve emphasises that today as well. He says, you know, we're not giving up our names. We're not giving up our identities.
Mm. But they won't.
But they will be far away from home, though.
They'll be far away from home and probably won't feel safe to come back into the country for holidays and that sort of thing. They may be able to, maybe as time goes on. But it's one of the things about the justice system and the law, and here we are talking about people law, and there was big meetings yesterday about people wanting to break the law and not paying household taxes. And as one minister said, look, you want the law on one side to protect you, and then on the other side you're willing to break it, and then when you want something, you've got to kind of be willing to
taxes. The logical follow-on
from people breaking the law is this is what it leads to. I mean, there was a guy on the Late Late Show Friday night from Limerick who told a horrific story about his experience, and the future for that guy is just so bleak at this stage. I can't remember his name, but
you're talking here about you know, we talk about evil and we talk about bad and we talk about good, and sometimes people in the media and everywhere else can be accused sometimes of being too flippant with the word evil. But let me tell you, for the absolute, to be unequivocal, I have never come across, on a personal level, the level of menace and pure malevolence from this group of people who drove Steve Collins out of his home. They are, as Steve said in your programme, Marion, about 2 years ago, they are pond life. They are mutants. These people are so inherently evil that five young men are now lying on their headstones in cemeteries around this city, because they were driven to suicide, because such was their sense of appalling desperation and fear of named individuals of this gang. You couldn't make it up. One of the only good thing about all of this for Steve, from his point of view, and Steve is somebody I'm honoured to say, and his family are friends of mine, and I'm deeply upset for them today. But the thing is that at the moment, the Dundons, as he said, are finally getting justice. April Collins, one of their own Molls, she was one of them. She knows all the secrets. She recently gave evidence in the case against John and Wayne Dundon, and they were both convicted of threatening to kill her and her mother in the Special Criminal Court. She has also given very important evidence in which led to the conviction of one of the men who murdered Shane Gagan. So they are imploding, they're on their knees, and it's so ironic that in turn it's their own evil that ate them up in the end because they started threatening to kill their own.
Yeah, Paul, Gerald Keane, listen, it's an excellent piece you've written. Can I just ask you, that was one thing that occurred to me. That lady who gave evidence, is she in a witness protection scheme or how is she going to survive, Paul?
Well, she is, Gerald. She's in the witness protection programme. Yeah.
Well, she is.
She have to be because... You know,
the whole
business is they want her dead now. She
needs,
they want to get her killed at all costs.
Right.
And they would do anything to do that.
When I say witness protection scheme, like, I mean, does that mean she's out of the country or is she, like...
No, my understanding is she's still in the country, but she's protected. She's constantly accompanied by armed police now. That's the rest of her life she's going to be like that.
And as somebody who's the most experienced journalist in the country in this area, are the guards making... inroads down there in sorting the problem?
Absolutely, they are. They've done an extraordinary job.
Yeah.
In fact, at the moment, you know, I've been writing about this for the past while, there's four or five serious players in all of this who are potentially, in the next number of months, going to face murder charges for the murder of Roy Collins, Shane Gagan, James Cronin, because of the evidence they've got. And the thing is that the worm is turning to the extent that the Dundons terrorised everybody in the prison system as well.
Mm.
They're no longer so-called men of respect, because respect in the underworld basically means fear. They're no longer men of any kind of respect.
Why not?
They've lost it. Because they're losing their power, because they're now being referred to in some circles as the McCarthy dum-dums, because they're now doing so much time for just making threats to people, because they felt that they could get away with just making threats left, right and centre. And Mark Heffernan, the guy who was on the Late Late Show, was one of the men they threatened. And he... helped get, including April Collins' father and her brother, who are two other members of the same Pond Life neighbourhood. They are all in prison because of Mark Heffernan. So people are starting to stand up to it. And this goes back to the net point about Roy Collins. If it wasn't for somebody like Roy Collins, people would not have felt that they could stand up against these people. And in the answer ultimately to Jerry's question there, you know, that they have... the police here are very much on top of these guys. But it illustrates, you know, no matter how much you're on top of them, the fear and the threat that they pose, and that ever-present threat, meant that people like Steve Collins couldn't find any kind of peace in his life. And had
but
to
Paul, could I just ask you, I mean, people have talked about this gang for some considerable time.
Mm.
Are our laws, I mean, I think if you talk to decent living people, they say, why can't they just grab them all and lock them up? Now, we know that can't be done. We can't go to that kind of internship.
No.
So, I mean, has Mr. Collins identified anything else that he would have suggested to ministers to actually change the law? I mean, our laws have got harsher and harsher. There's no two ways since even the time I was there with the Criminal Assets Bureau and onwards. And even the Criminal Assets Bureau in its early days had to be amended as the criminals discovered ways of challenging various parts of it. We now have the gangland law, but I think there's been only, if there has been one prosecution under it, I think that's about all there has. Because the proof of saying you're a gang, they're not like the gangs in the kind of glamour gangs that they did
Westlife.
I'll tell you one thing, by the way.
I mean, it's very difficult to know, is there more that state can do?
Sam, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, I was going to say, Paul, that presumably we have enough law. Every time there's another outrage, governments rush in and bring in yet another act or something like that. Presumably we have enough law
to cover any
circumstance. You have just said that you expect, presumably within months, that most of the leaders of these gangs will be in prison. Will that basically be the end then to the terror that's been running Limerick for the past generation?
Well, certainly, Sam, that will be the hope, because, you know, and you are right, it is the traditional criminology that will lead to these people being convicted if they are convicted and charged, because it is basically witnesses coming forward, telling what they know, providing evidence and proof to corroborate what they're saying, and then them going before a jury or in the special criminal court or wherever, and then the judges and the jury will decide, and then they will be taken out of the picture. And if people get life in relation to any of these crimes, it will mean life for them, absolutely.
Yeah, because there is the perception as well, and, you know, I know that there is a view there that you should lock them up and throw away the key, but there's another view that you kind of walk in one door and you're out the other door because you're getting your 25%. Catherine McGuinness, do you take a view on this?
Well, a view of which, I mean, I would agree with Sam that there has been repeated more severe laws brought in. But in fact, I think very few of these laws are really used. And as Paul has said, it's the ordinary criminal law that people get convicted. You are certainly, I'm hopeful that he's right in saying that the main people on the in the McCarthy Dundon gang and the Limerick people of that ilk are will be convicted, and they will serve long terms in jail, because certainly with murder convictions we have made the amount of time you spend in jail longer and longer. I mean, it's people are mistaken if they think it's just 7 years. These are not the people who are allowed out the front door, the back door, as soon as they come in the front door. These people are kept for lengthy times in jail. They're very difficult to deal with in jail, because their violence and criminology doesn't stop because they've walked into Mountjoy. And one of the huge difficulties, as I found a lot about when I was on the Thornton Hall Review Committee, is the difficulty of containing the gangs that are in the jail. Because even if you separate sort of gang A and gang B, then they're the people who belong to them change around, change their allegiances, and there's still a danger within the prison. So that it's a very difficult task to deal with the imprisonment of these people. But they are among the people that are for lengthy terms in prison. But I don't. The difficulty about saying that that may solve the situation is that these things pass from generation to generation. I mean, there's a generation of young people growing up in certain parts of Limerick that have utterly rejected education, that have utterly rejected ordinary life. Yeah. And unless we do something at that end and start trying to bring these people away from the culture that has prevailed, you know, it won't be the end. A new generation of criminals will grow up.
Okay, Paul. It was a sad. It was a sad day that he did have to leave. Though I have to tell you, I often thought he was nearly too brave for his own safety.
Yeah. Well, he was. He's not a foolhardy man, that's for sure. But he's an extremely. You've met him, Marion, and he's an extremely warm, decent man.
That's
and his family, they're just such lovely people. And, you know, it is heartbreaking to think
let us hope.
What they've been through the past 3 years. It's just, you know, I've been sort of an observer of that on a close level to them for the past 3 years. And, you know, when the light, when the cameras were off them and the mics were switched off, they still had to go home and sit and think. And
be protected by armed guards outside the door. Yeah. Okay, listen, Paul, thank you very, very much indeed for talking to us. And that brings us up to 12 noon, and we go to the newsroom and Michael Murphy.